down in town.
For the first time.
This is Jim. And,
receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. Have accessed entry 958.JB3826, certificate number 49394. Point Nemo.
Now, if you want Dapper Dan, I can order it for you, have it in a couple of weeks.
Well, ain't this place a geographical oddity? 2 weeks from everywhere.
Is there a...
Is this a tennis score?
Yes. Point Nemo. Nemo's a Romanian tennis star in this scenario. Is there a point in your life?
Yes, Point Nemo.
A Point Nemo. Is there a Point Nemo in your life?
Yes.
Where you're talking to a wasted surfer turtle, and a forgetful blue tang,
a limping fish arrives.
No, like what point in your life did you feel the most isolated? Like not emotionally, like not right now talking to me. But like, was there a point when you just felt like
the furthest away,
geographically alone, like physically far from the madding crowd?
Well, yeah, probably the furthest I've been from the nearest human was in Alaska.
Oh, sure.
Like up in the area around Denali National Park, although not in the park, but out just outside the park. But I was with a friend, so the two of us were as alone as you could be.
Still. I mean, because in that scenario, you do want to be with another person.
Yeah. But we were, you know, we were in a place where if we had needed help, we would have had to have snowshoed 10 kilometers to a radio.
Does it feel different, just that knowledge?
Yeah.
That there's no grid?
I mean, when you're 20, it's amazing. When you're 50, I wonder if it would feel different.
Because 20-year-olds do not have the neurons required to think, if I twisted my ankle, could I get back on that trail? What time does it get dark this time of year? You know, all the things that,
yeah,
that
but
normal
also,
surviving people think of.
At 20, you think, and the thing was, I went into the Talkeetna River because my kayak overturned and I lost my glasses and we had to... You know, not just getting to shore, but then getting me warm required that we throw everything we owned into a fire we hastily built just to get me, you know, to stop shivering.
That's a genuine survival scenario.
And that felt like just another day in paradise. You know,
it's
we're
Alaska.
20.
That's Alaska, baby.
Hey, that was hot. You know, like, oh, I'm warm now. What do we do next?
But you're framing it as like a matter of character. And I literally think it's like neurons not connecting yet.
Oh, it absolutely was.
Like your brain is not ready for prime time if you're like, hey, you know, we did it. Have a, you know, toss me a Coors.
My glasses went down river. And for the next month, I couldn't see at all. But I was just... You know, you just adjust to that. And, you know, and we were in the...
And some bear is like wearing glasses and having the opposite problem.
I'm like, sweetheart, where did you come from? I didn't know you were up here. But I think the furthest I was alone from other people was probably in the Carpathian Mountains. But that...
I couldn't believe you went to Alaska first and not the Balkans.
No. Yeah, the Balkans next. But you know... I'm still in Europe at that point, so sure. You're not that far.
There's probably like a train station with service every 8 minutes, like like 6 miles away.
But definitely 20 kilometers from a place.
Yeah.
But in, up in Denali, yeah, there was no place. I guess, come to think of it, you could have walked to the railroad. You could have walked, and because in the Alaska Railroad will stop if you flag it down.
Because that's not an uncommon thing, I'm guessing.
No, there are whole communities, not communities, but there are people on the regular. There's a regular stretch of the train where it's a regular thing.
Oh, that's how you hop on.
You flag the train down and it will stop, and you give them enough. You know, they know the distance.
This is not somebody who's lost. This is just somebody who's. That's how they get to.
Hey, you know, but they don't do it every week, right? They come out twice a year.
Sure, when the snow melts.
So we could have gotten there, but it would have been a long walk, and you're just waiting for the train whenever it comes.
I've never really, you know, I enjoy being in the forest, and I enjoy being away from the city lights at night. But you know, it's always pretty well trodden hiking and camping scenarios. Like, I don't know if I've ever had that realization that. Yeah, if I twist my ankle going down this mountain, like, what even happens?
Have you pulled off the road in, you know, way out Utah or Nevada or something and turned off the car in the middle of the night and gotten out?
Yeah.
Where you can see by moonlight to the horizon and there's nothing, but you have a car.
You have a car. And it's the interstate. At night, you might not see anybody. I don't know if I've ever really done it on a back road, but you do get the sense of aloneness, but never like the, I was reading, I kind of went down a rabbit hole reading about, this is actually for a recent addenda show for Patreon. I was reading about a kind of amateur search and rescue guys in Death Valley. And this is some guy where this is pretty much his life, the thrill of the chase. And even he gets to some part, you know, in search of these lost tourists, he gets to some part of Death Valley where he kind of realizes, I have never felt this remote in my life. If something were to happen to my water supply here, I don't have a backup plan.
Right.
And you know, he's, you know, in a car, he's a few minutes from a ranger station or whatever, but on foot, he suddenly realizes it's just me out here against everything.
There's a kind of, like a, I don't know, a mania that I've seen a couple of times. And I felt when you're out, that remotely where you get energized by it.
You just want to head out?
Yeah. And in fact, one of these times, cause we would, when we were on tour, you know, we would already be on a back road. It'd be the middle of the night and I would turn off the headlights sometimes cause the moon would be out.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time I'd be driving and everybody would be asleep. And a couple of times then from one of those roads, I would pull off on a dirt road and drive and drive and drive and drive until we were far, far away. And one of those, and then I'd wake everybody up. And one of those times we were all standing out there in that, it's a, like a lunar landscape. And especially because it's dark and the moon.
And Nevada looks like the moon anyway. Yeah. So that's why they shot it there.
And one of the guys in my band, the keyboard player at the time, Chris, said, leave me here. It was the end of a tour. We were headed back to Seattle, but we had two more days of driving just to get home. And he was like, leave me here. I want to walk home. And I said, no, I can't leave you here. He was like, no, I insist. Like, this is what I want. This is what I want. I want you to leave me here and I want to walk home.
And are you saying no, not on the basis of you're not making a good decision, but really on the basis of this would not be safe?
Both. Like, whatever is happening to you right now, whatever is going through your mind, like, I'm familiar with a few different kinds of mania and I recognize that this is a bad decision, but also like, I'm not going to get back to Seattle and explain to your girlfriend that I left you in.
He's probably
Nowheresville. And he, of all the people I knew at the time, he had the internal resources to survive it. But no, I mean, I know it looks like you could just go from here to there, but that's a long way away and there's nothing between here and there and you have nothing.
What's the explanation for that just lure of the horizon? I mean,
I don't know.
I guess it propagates strong. The species. There's probably an evolutionary, you know, at some point there's too many people in the village and somebody's got to go see the resources over there.
Yeah. I was explaining to my daughter that in most cultures at a certain point, a certain number of the non-conforming young men get sent out.
Because otherwise you get too many of them knocking heads and they make trouble.
You're right. Get out, you know, and keep moving. And so, I mean, of all the people I knew at the time, Chris was the non-conforming young man that we would have kicked out and told to go to the Horizon. So he had it baked in.
And did it work? Is he currently running a sex cult in Eastern Oregon or something?
Yeah, basically he is in Oregon. I can't attest to the sex cult.
Because he made you sign a thing.
Well, I don't. He's living on a. He's living where there's no radios, so I can't contact him.
Wow. So even though you brought him back, he just turned around and left again.
Turned around and went right back.
You can take the boy out of Burns, Oregon, but you can't take Burns, Oregon out of the boy.
But you've been to Antarctica.
That's true.
And
that's certainly isolation.
Do you have do you feel that in yourself, a desire to be, I mean, we all kind of toy with the fantasy of like, I just want to get away. But do you ever want to go to the horizon? I mean, Mindy wouldn't be there to tell you how to live.
And that's the idea, is that I would be missing that, or that I would be craving the getaway.
Yeah, that you would be helpless without it.
Yeah, exactly. That's more correct than, she can finally finish Great British Bake Off.
Like, where are my reading glasses? Mindy? Oh, there's no Mindy here.
I feel like the appeal for me would just be like, you know, the sights and sounds. It's more of a sensory and possibly even like kind of an acquisitive, like a collector's impulse. Like, I've got to see this that I've never seen. I got to see this before it's gone. But I guess the history of human exploration is very much somebody. Oh, you know what I do have is like on a hike or a walk, and my kids will attest to this because it drives them bananas. I'll be like, oh, but we. It looks like if we just get over that next rise, there's something new to see. Or, well, what's around this corner? You know, like you're always kind of drawn by, what if I missed the thing around the next bend? And I guess that's kind of the lure of the horizon. Yeah. You know, what's the next vista? What's the next landscape? But it's never like, I need to get further away from something.
Are you a hiker that's fooled by false horizons?
Yeah, I mean, endlessly,
like false summits.
That looks like that might be the top.
Hey, look, you can see the light through the trees. And then it's like, no. Nope.
And even when you get to a real summit, you're like, hey, look at that summit over there. Yeah, that one might even be taller.
For sure. Is that a cabin over there?
And so I'm susceptible to that. Who would you say, this is a Guinness Book certified, so it must be true. Who would you say is the most isolated human being in history? Is it
Livingston?
Bill Cosby right now. Livingston.
Would it be someone in Siberia?
You can do better than Siberia, actually. This has to be somebody who is, I think, by currently? Guinness's math, no. 2,200 was 2,200 miles away from any other beating heart.
A shipwreck? Somebody shipwrecked in the Pitcairn Islands?
Further.
Oh, well, it would be Neil Armstrong.
It's space. Yeah. Yeah. Michael Collins, when he stayed in the command module, Apollo 11, he was famously the loneliest man, you know, because the press loved the idea that he's just up there all alone.
Right.
And if you interview Collins, he's not romantic at all. He was like, no, there were some white mice I was tending to. It was actually very restful. I mean, all these guys were fighter pilots. Sure. They don't care about like being alone in a box.
Sure. No, the guys at Mission Control were shocking me the whole time.
Well, what they loved, I guess, to a man, all the command module guys say they loved the backside of the moon, because then Houston left them alone.
Oh, sure.
Like they didn't even have radio contact. You know, they were just like, finally, they could just
get 4 hours of sleep,
chill and sleep and do the Wordle. Michael Collins is not the most isolated human being because, his record was beaten on Apollo 15 in the summer of 1971. Al Warden stayed in the command module, and I guess because of the particular choice of landing sites,
he was further away.
He was further away, 2,200 miles away. And that was like the first J-length mission or whatever, so it was like a full three-day thing, you know, more moonwalks than, you know, because Neil and Buzz were there for like 8 minutes or, you know, they had a very brief stay.
A little longer. I mean, it was
hours because they landed and took, and they were supposed to take a nap. You know, they had time to.
Right. But they didn't like unfold the little car and drive around, visit all the moon men.
Yeah. They didn't have the little car.
Although I thought you were going to say, no. The furthest person actually was a Soviet guy that missed the moon.
He's still there.
And as long as they could record his beating heart, he was still alive.
We don't know. Is it the two naked people in the Voyager probe? Like, we thought they were just a drawing, but that was actually Carl Sagan actually just like, shot two naked people into space just to see what happened. The Al Warden's actually kind of a sad story. This should probably be its own omnibus. Do you remember the stamp collecting fiasco related to the Apollo missions?
Oh, God, vaguely. What is it?
The crew of Apollo 15 had been approached by a couple of different philately
nerds. Oh, they carried stamps.
Like, take these postal covers, like stamped envelopes, into the moon. Because then, you know, stamp collectors will go nuts for stamps that have been on the moon. Like, well, I mean, they'll go nuts for stamps that haven't been on the moon.
Sure.
They'll go nuts for stamps.
Stamps that have Oprah on them.
The red ink is a little out of alignment or whatever. So, and these guys agreed, and I don't think it like violated any rules at the time, and maybe Deke Slayton even passed off. I can't remember, but they got back and they were supposed to hold off. It was just, you know, astronauts weren't that well paid. It was like a legacy for their retirement. And instead they, at least in Al's case, he gave the postal covers to some collector immediately, and the guy started reselling them. And it led to headlines and congressional hearings. And yeah, and even though no rules were broken, just the idea that this is some starry-eyed new frontier and we're already selling merch. Our steely-eyed missile men are selling merch to West German stamp collectors.
I never thought about this, but did those guys fill their pockets with moon rocks? I mean, there's hardly a thing more valuable than a moon rock.
I think there were pretty strict weight limits. So yeah, they did bring back stuff, but they brought back the exact mass and volume they were ordered to.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what the margin of error there is. But
there's hardly anything to bring back from the moon besides moon
what
rocks.
Else would you think you would find there?
I think a really hilarious Arrowheads? Thing would bring be to bring the flag that Neil Armstrong planted back, like wrapped in your jacket.
There's only one of these.
To sell to a West German stamp collector.
Maybe you could, it probably had a collapsible pole. Maybe I'm you sure could smuggle that aboard.
Yeah.
You know, like there was the guy that smuggled aboard the pastrami sandwich or whatever.
And when the next people came to the moon, they'd be like, wasn't there a, like a really iconic flag here?
I swear it was right here. Like the car is there. Honey, we parked right there. There's the little car. Warden actually got kind of drummed out of NASA for his stamp hijinks. Which is crazy. I mean, he's an Air Force guy who now realizes that the whiff of scandal means his Air Force promotion career is effectively over. And, you know, NASA, Deke Slayton won't fly him anymore. So he kind of had to find his own way. And I guess he did find some sympathetic administrator at NASA and landed somewhere.
Yeah.
But
well, man, and what you do is go get a job at Blackwater with Dick Cheney, right?
Do they hire astronauts?
I'm sure. Are you kidding? All those places want to hire astronauts.
But there were days where he was 22 miles away from another human being, which is, you know, now that we've forgotten his stamp misdeeds, his philatelic misdeeds.
That's his claim to fame. 22 miles would not be that hard to achieve.
2,200 miles?
Oh, 2,200 miles.
He was 22 miles.
I feel like
from any other human.
22 miles? I've been 22 miles.
But the thing about, you know, Earth is big enough that, you know, 2,200 miles is a, I mean, that's not beyond the realm of possibility for how far you could be away from civilization on Earth. It's a little more, but not that much, as we will see.
It's the width of the United States plus, minus several hundred miles, right? Sure. How wide is the U.S.? 3,000 miles?
3,000, yeah. So let's say everybody today from west of the Mississippi just all headed to Columbus, Ohio for, you know, I don't know, Dave Matthews concert.
Do it. Everybody do it. Let's start right now.
If you're listening right now, but you and I are like, we're not going to do it.
Not going to do it.
I don't need to see Dave Matthews.
No, and also Seattle will be empty finally.
Yes. And then we would kind of have the apocalypse. And we'd be, you know, if we could arrange for all the Canadians to do it and all the ships at sea to kind of head towards Japan a bit. I guess Hawaii is probably right around that, right? 2,200 miles to Hawaii.
You know, I don't know if you know this, but I once walked from Amsterdam to Istanbul.
What?
Yeah. And that distance is 2,700 kilometers.
So it's a little under 2,200. What is that?
Yeah, 2,700 kilometers maybe? To miles is...
Exciting. Conversions in real time.
Yeah, 1,677.
Interesting. Miles. 1,670 miles is the exact distance that makes Point Nemo remarkable.
Really?
So you walked, essentially...
To Point Nemo.
Although, in your case, Point Nemo was Istanbul and had nicer mosques.
And from now on, I'm going to say I walked from Amsterdam to Point Nemo.
That would be a longer walk. This idea of this entry today is about the most inaccessible points on Earth, given our current coastlines. And, you know, we're speaking to a future water world that has different geographic math here, different geodetics.
Sure, but the kelp beds will have become both sentient and also inhabitable by other creatures.
Yeah, you know, they're going to have new dry land. They're going to have floating coral cities and all the rest. It's going to be fantastic.
Trash gyres that become mega cities.
But given our current coastlines, in the 20th century, humanity started exhausting its exploration options. I mean, Amundsen getting to the South Pole in, what is that, 1911 or 1912 or whatever that is. It's kind of the death knell until we invent better rocket propellants, or indeed rocketry at all.
At the time, was he the furthest beating heart from another?
Yeah. I mean, if you don't count his expedition and his dogs. I mean, it would have been the ship he came from.
The ship you came from.
The ship you rode in on, rolled. But once the poles had been reached, you know how people are. It's like, you know, all these horizon seeking guys, which again, we've said might be an evolutionary trait and not merely a, just restless
trend,
restless masculine urge or a cultural trend or a, who can I enslave, self-interested, ambition.
It certainly was a cultural trend for,
if it's a def, it becomes a definition of its cachet and coolness.
Yeah. But then also it is a innate thing. 'Cause why are we here? Why is anybody anywhere?
You got to assume for some of these guys, the cinnamon and cloves was just the
pretext.
Otherwise,
you know. Otherwise, the population of the Rift Valley would be 6 billion people. And God,
Vasco da Gama just had a fight with Senora da Gama,
and he was like, "You know what?
You know, I'm getting really into cinnamon and cloves now.
I'm going out for a pack of cigarettes. I'll be back." That's a New Yorker cartoon. It's got to be.
Is that even a trope anymore?
It's gotta be.
Like, I wonder if, like, the number of times that joke has been told exceeds the number of dads who actually, because now you couldn't use that as an excuse. It's like saying the dog ate my homework.
Oh, to go out for a pack of cigarettes? Well, my grandfather went out for a pack of cigarettes and hopped on a freight train and went to California. It's a literal thing that he actually said on his way out the door.
Did he not know there were cigarettes closer by?
I think he did. That's part of the story.
He had an inkling.
I'm going out for some California cigarettes.
Once there were flags in the poles, these guys, and they were largely guys, needed...
Let's just call them guys.
They needed a new project.
These guys.
These sturdy guys.
You know what? These guys need a new project.
It's all about a project.
Yeah.
It's all about a project.
I think we need to start referring to these guys as these guys, because there are these guys.
Like, Vasco da Gama could have just, like, cleaned his gutters or put in new countertops or something.
Right. Built a lean-to.
There are plenty of other options. And nowadays, Shortcut to India is not an option. So, you know, people have to.
What do these guys do? These guys now are starting militias in their hometowns.
Some of them. I mean, luckily there's virtual exploration. You might think that playing Zelda is keeping a lot of these guys off the street.
Oh, or Sims.
Yeah, exactly.
They're building stuff in Minecraft.
They've got worlds to explore, but they're, you know, everything, now that everything else is mapped, it's got to be a fictional one.
What was that thing I read just the other day, that there was some online kids multiverse that a bunch of people had created sex dungeons in?
What?
And they were...
The kids had, or,
no,
or
not
interlopers?
The kids, interlopers.
Somebody sneaking around in my Minecraft nether?
Yeah, people are like, wow, I need a new play, a new sex dungeon. And
in the metaverse,
and they went into some place that was like, yay, happy pink dinosaurs.
I guess that is the argument for banking on the metaverse. It's not just, it's not all blockchain Ponzi schemes, although it's 90% blockchain Ponzi schemes, but a lot of it is, we assume these restless young people are going to need a project and a frontier. And if there's no real ones, maybe we can sell them on this phony one in a helmet.
Have you ever watched one of those live space combat games where it's not like pew pew pew? It's more, it's strategy, and the gamers are talking to each other on headsets. I mean, I'm sure Dylan plays these things, right?
Like a Fortnite or whatever.
I don't know, but my
kids are playing all these.
I was looking over the shoulder of somebody playing one of these games where it seemed impossibly boring, but they were all super engaged in, I don't know. It felt like capture the flag.
I mean, almost. That's one thing about real exploration. It's mundane, yeah. Right? It's boring. It's long days of loneliness and solving problems like where do we get fresh water next?
But I definitely looked over this person's shoulder at all of the spaceships that were arrayed around some nebula. And I kept looking over into outer space going, well, what's over there?
Go over there, you
what
guys.
What the hell are you doing? Don't worry about these guys. Like, you're in space with a rocket. Like, go show me what's over there. And I do think if you were that vested in an online world, you could fool that part of your brain.
Yeah, I almost think it doesn't even matter if the interface is convincing or not. You don't have to feel the wind in your hair if whatever that part of your brain is being satisfied by the question of what's over there.
I wonder if that's at the drive behind entrepreneurship even. I mean, anything where you get so absorbed that you're like, Mom, get out of my room. It's like, I'm here, you know, I'm on a spaceship to somewhere. It's a blockchain Ponzi scheme, but yeah, like if I die in this world, I die in the real world.
I don't think that's true of the blockchain.
Are you sure?
If you go bankrupt in the metaverse, you go bankrupt in the real world. They've made sure that's true. So lacking real milestones anymore, like geographic ones like North Poles, you know, would-be explorers had to come up with increasingly arcane, if not arbitrary, places they could visit where nobody had.
There's tens of thousands of square miles of mosquito-infested muskeg in Siberia that anyone could still...
But what distinguishes any given fen from the one
right.
10 miles east, you know? This one
has 50 mosquitoes per square inch. And
clearly there's ego involved because you want to announce the thing you were about to do and then the thing you did.
I made it to a place that no one will ever want to be. I made it to a place that even more people wouldn't want to be.
You know, our mutual friend, Randall Monroe, the XKCD guy,
yes.
spends a lot of time just exploring on Google Earth. And a lot of it is weird Siberian fens and stuff because he thinks there's imagery out here that hasn't had eyeballs on it.
Yeah, a fantastic. Well, that game where Google Earth will put you on any road,
Geo-guessing.
But then also just going, zooming in, looking down at something only the satellite has seen. God, I spend a lot of time doing that too.
He knows I'm very interested in places that have islands in lakes, on islands, in larger lakes.
There's only a
on
couple islands. Of those. Right?
Yeah, but they're all in weird polar places, you know, where these crazy.
Yeah.
Networks of lakes form at the right time of
year. Oh, so he's out there searching because you've given him a Sisyphean task?
I feel like he might have been on it sooner. Like, when I wrote my book about maps, I discovered people online that were interested in, like, how big the bullseye gets.
I can see that he would have been.
I think he might be an early adopter.
Early adopter, thought leader in that.
But he's still doing it. He's always sending me imagery. He's like, check out this weird, you know, he found some exactly circular igneous thing in Siberia that's not a crater or an impact.
And not volcanic.
It is volcanic, but it's neither a crater nor a meteor impact. It's just
a blister popped.
A thing where lava makes, or magma, I guess, makes an exact circular ridge for whatever.
It's got to be a bubble.
Whatever
bubble.
Physical reason. I don't think anything ever popped there. It just grew like that. He's always sending me weird views from space.
But that's flirting, you know.
It is. He's got a girlfriend. But a lot of these places are in the... Oh, maybe married. Maybe they're married, actually. But a lot of these places are in the far north or south, you know, these remote places. And that was true in the 20s as well, when people started to invent the ideas of what's the... Now that we've been to the poles, are there even harder places than the poles to get to? And there are, because of the geographical concept of what's now called poles of inaccessibility.
But can you push a wheelbarrow there?
I mean, there is that as well. Okay, somebody's been there with a dog sled, but has anybody been there on foot?
Right.
Has anybody, you know, and it started with planes, then it was dog sleds, now it's on foot, now it's who can do it in the most inhospitable time of the year.
With no oxygen.
Yeah, who can do Everest without oxygen, who can put on a fish concert
in Burlington, Vermont. How many fish concerts can you have in Burlington, Vermont at any one time?
So people realize that there is a place further from civilization and indeed from dry land than the North Pole. There's another pole up there, and it's close to the North Pole, but it's the place that's exactly the furthest from any other dry land.
In the north?
In the north, or in any ocean.
What is it?
It's called the Northern Point of Inaccessibility, and you calculate it. You can
NPOA?
Yeah, kind of. that's why the show is called Point Nemo, because it got a fun name in the 90s. You could basically, what you're doing is you're trying to, it's all triangles. You're trying to figure out what's the center of an equilateral triangle that connects three points. In the case of the North Pole, it's going to be one point in northern Canada, one point in Greenland, and one point in Siberia somewhere. And that will inscribe a circle. And that's like the largest circle you can make in the Arctic Ocean. And the center of that circle is the hardest place to get to, at least distance-wise. And you can show off if you say you went there, even though man has already been to the magnetic pole and the geographic pole.
Is it in Canada? Or is it north of Hudson's Bay? Where
it's in, yeah, it's in nothing. It's close enough to the...
It's in the water.
I mean, it's exactly, like, by definition, it's exactly equidistant between Russia, Canada, and Greenland, right. And it's, yeah, in the water, or if you go in the winter, presumably, it's on ice.
I've never understood the geographic center of the United States, because it must be changed by Alaska and Hawaii, right? Or
it was
changed. There are two, there's the contiguous United States, and then the other United States.
And there's a North America one nearby.
And then there's the population center of the United States, which is also somewhere in Iowa.
And that one moves quite often. That one has been creeping.
It's in Oklahoma now or something, right?
Creeping northwest, maybe, as people move to the Sun Belt.
I thought it was creeping southwest. It's on a line that went from, like, Indiana to...
You can see it move, which is interesting. I mean, you can't sit and watch it, but on census data, you can see it move. It is now in Missouri, and it's moving... For many years, it was moving basically west. You know, the first time we have data, it's like in eastern Maryland. It's very close to the Delaware border. And, you know, and... over the next century, it gets to Indiana, but it's pretty much moving due west. And now it's finally, you know, in the 20th century, it started to track south. Yeah, I guess that's true. I guess
it's all the people in Phoenix. They're tipping the scales. Phoenix, San Diego, and Los Angeles.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Are outweighing.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Portland.
The Sun Belt makes it move south. The growth in Texas and Florida and Phoenix. And now it's getting close to the Missouri-Arkansas border. But there is
the heart of America,
right? But that is different than the pole, the center of America, the place where if you cut out America in cardboard, where it would balance on a pin, the geodetic center, that's different than the point of inaccessibility.
Right.
Continents have points of inaccessibility as well, but instead of being the furthest place from dry land, it's the furthest place from the coasts.
Right.
Where would you guess that North America's center of inaccessibility is?
Would it be Winnipeg?
It's a little bit further south, but yeah, you're close. It's South Dakota.
Yeah.
It's actually on Oglala Sioux Reservation. It's just a few miles outside the city of Allen, South Dakota, which in, I think, the 2010 census was the most economically depressed municipality in America, you know, due to the realities of
reservation life.
Average per capita income in Allen, South Dakota, $1,539 per annum.
Oh dear.
But
hard to live on.
No.
$1,000 a year.
In Seattle, you just can't do that anymore. In 1990, maybe, but that's, you know, just in a copse of trees, just a few miles outside of town. There is a point which it turns out, if you crunch the numbers on a big computer, you are exactly 1,030 miles from three different oceans. It's the center of this triangle. I assume it's James Bay cutting down from Hudson Bay in the north, and then it's Galveston, Texas. It's the Gulf of Mexico. And on the Pacific, I bet it's right around, you know, it might be like Longview, Washington or something there. You know, that might be your closest point. But the center of that triangle is a place where you could visit. And now that GPS is available to the consumer, people do hike outside of town and take a picture of them at the at the furthest, literally the middle of nowhere, the middle America, the farthest you can be from an ocean in the center of this continent.
I was not far from there just recently, but didn't
you could have
know
been.
Enough to stop.
The Pine Ridge Reservation has cannily made it into a destination. Most of these, you know, every continent, every landmass, and every ocean has its own point of inaccessibility. And most are not marked, and most are never visited. You know, the one in Africa is right on the border between the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the Central African Republic, and South Sudan. So for various
lot of reasons, not
geopolitical and physical reasons, you know, there's not a lot of visitors there. Australia's is marked because it's, you know, the smallest continent, and there's, you know, there's dirt roads you can get nearby. Last year, the Lakota Sioux put up the Oglala Sioux put up a massive monument at the center of, or at the point of inaccessibility, with inscriptions about the seven virtues of Lakota life and so forth, you know, in hopes of kind of drawing people to this geographic oddity.
When we were down in the Four Corners area of the United States, we drove kind of at sundown. We had, it's not a very accessible place.
The actual Four Corners spot.
And we were like, we're going to the Four Corners, you know, the sun's going down, we'll get there right at sunset. And we got there and it's actually fenced off and there's an admission charge. And I think it's because it's on a reservation.
Yeah.
And so they had just closed the gate. And we were like,
For evening or for COVID or
for evening. We were like, but we just want to, you know, we're here.
Four states.
It's not like we can come back tomorrow. but we were just saying that to a sign that said closed. There wasn't anybody there that we were arguing to.
You didn't try to break in.
But it did feel like, oh, right, that could be a thing that's open all night. I don't know. If you're only charging, we would have paid $50.
Someone had to think of points of inaccessibility. I think there's records in the late 20s of people talking about it in terms of the Arctic. You know, how do you get to what's the hardest point in the Arctic to get to? That's the new way to get sponsors and headlines and an article in the National Geographic. And so there was a Soviet plane that went over that point it's 626 miles from land on all three sides. There was a Soviet plane that went over in 41. A British explorer named, I think, Wally Herbert got there on a dog sled in 68. But in 2013, with, you know, they're just doing the math on the back of an, you know, they're just kind of using one of those circle drawing compasses on a chart in the 20s. In 2013, a researcher named Ted Scambos actually, I think, fed this into a computer and found out that everybody had been fully 133 miles off.
Oh, busted.
Given what we now know about, because, you know, it's very hard to say where the coastline of the Arctic is. You know, where does the ice cap end? Or when? You know, around 2040, possibly.
I just Googled the geographic center of Antarctica to see what it was.
Yeah. Are you looking at what I think you're looking at?
Well, what I'm looking at is, it was just white. And so I switched over to the satellite view, which is also just white.
Well, if there's Google Street View there, there actually is something to see.
Well, let me zoom down here.
I don't know if it's...
I don't think there's Street View.
Why not? In 1958, the Soviets Soviets in a burst of Cold War competitive pride decided they would put a weather station at the Antarctic point of inaccessibility as it was then measured. Huh. And this would be a sign of their, you know, hardy superiority. You know, no other place on Earth more inhospitable or harder to get to than this.
And yet
the crew lasted exactly
totally compatible with Marxism.
Well, yeah. And it turns out Antarctica is not compatible with Marxism. The crew lasted exactly 2 weeks.
Oh.
And then they realized this is just too hard to keep this place supplied. And,
yeah,
you know, the meteorological benefit that we are giving to mankind does not justify the harshness of the environment and the remoteness of its location. But it's still there today. I don't know if it's exactly where you're looking, but there is still a deserted hut from this weather station, which they... I think the imaginatively called Point of Inaccessibility Station.
You know, Google loves this kind of thing, but they did not, they're not featuring it. And weirdly, if you go down to Antarctica on Google Earth,
okay,
it will not let you go over the South Pole and come around the other side.
Because you know why? It'd be upside down. It'd freak you out.
That's exactly it. It would be upside down. You'd be looking at South America upside down, and it doesn't want you to do it. So it keeps you oriented.
It keeps you in a north-centric.
Yeah.
Sorry, Global South. Google Earth's keeping you down.
North-centric. So you can't actually like get a view on Google Earth of just the South Pole kind of centered.
But if you were actually there, there is a deserted hut with still a bust of Lenin atop it.
Awesome.
Often, you know, almost lost in the snowdrifts.
Awesome.
So that is, I guess it is compatible with Marxism.
Goodness the Germans didn't get there first, and there's a hut down there with a bust of Hitler on it. Can you imagine how that would just... How many people would just be seething?
Well, the Soviets didn't get there till 1958. So if you're putting a bust of Hitler on your weather station in 1958, you got some problems.
There are some people in South America that were building huts with Hitler on the top in 58.
You know, going back to the Arctic one for a second, now that we have better data and we know that nobody's done it, there is this kind of the last of the British polar explorers is this guy named Jim McNeil, a retired scientist, who has made multiple attempts to get to the Arctic point of inaccessibility.
Oh, and it's so inaccessible that no one's been there?
Now that we know we've been 130 miles off, there's no record of anyone having been to the new one. And McNeil calls it the last significant place on Earth as yet unreached by mankind. He's made multiple trips. In 2003, he was stopped by flesh-eating bacteria on his ankle. That'll turn you back.
Huh, that seems like something he brought with him.
In 2006, he fell through the ice on day 17 and... you know, had to abort the expedition. But he is constantly he runs this thing called the Ice Warrior Project, where he's reframing exploration as kind of a boot camp thing. You know, like, you too can be a polar explorer. Come, and, you know, he...
as long as you're rich enough to not have to get a job.
Well, that's the thing. He frames it as, what a great new frontier for science to teach a new generation about all that can be learned by exploring the Earth's most remote points. But really... it's a way to, I guess, entrepreneurize exploration.
There you go. Because that's what we needed.
He's saying, who has $25,000? I'll take you to the North Pole. And so he calls it the last pole, which is very catchy and is always on the lookout for. A couple of years ago, he had a want ad for 28 volunteers, each with $25,000, because he's going to make a man out of you.
It will look great on a fleece jacket. As you know, a fleece jacket with a logo on it is... what every billionaire does to commemorate their ego exploration.
But now that they can all go into space, I don't know if any of them care about a kind of a fairly arbitrary spot or an unremarkable spot, at least, in the Arctic Ocean.
I have found the pole of inaccessibility research station in Antarctica.
Is Lenin above the snow today? Is this a live cam?
But I do not see that the resolution of at least this that I'm on shows you the hut.
You can't see the hut, much less the bust.
Show me the hut.
What? So Lenin's not a cam girl, is what you're saying.
Apparently not. Although I'm sure there's somebody listening who works for somebody, for some organization that has higher resolution cameras.
We just need an organization of dedicated young leftists to go down and blow the snow off of Lenin occasionally. Right?
Yeah.
Would it kill him?
As long as they all have... it's the kind of leftists that we love here that all have $25,000 to spend.
That's right. That's why you can't tax the rich. They won't go snowblow Lenin. Of course, there is one place on Earth further from dry land than the center of North America, and that would be the center of Eurasia. The overall land point of inaccessibility is... and you got a guess here?
The overall...
yeah, where in Eurasia are you furthest from water, or furthest from the ocean?
Kazakhstan.
Yes, almost. Yay! Exactly right. It's actually in Xinjiang, China.
Every time I Uyghur say China. Something, you're like, yes, actually.
Well, it's so close. No. It's so close to the Kazakh border. Okay. It's so close to the border. I'm going to give it to you.
Thank you.
I'm a game show host for a living.
You are.
I can give you control of the board here.
Survey says...
Kazakhstan.
Bing!
Ding. Good answer. There's one of the major cities of that part of Uyghur China is called Urumqi. And based on some earlier math, they've actually erected a tourist attraction in their suburbs, being like, this is it, the center of the Eurasian continent. In fact, there's some controversy that all comes down to the Gulf of Ob.
Oh,
as it so often
once
does.
Once again, the Gulf of Ob.
Troublemaker. You know how the north, if you look at the Arctic coast of Siberia on a map, it's got all these kind of gashes and inlets and slashes.
Gashes and slashes, they call it.
And the question is, at what point does the Ob River become a river, in which case it shouldn't count against this? And
it's a delta.
At what point is that little V part of the open ocean? And depending on where you count that Ob, it moves the center of Eurasia pretty dramatically.
It is a very long fjord.
Yes.
And
do you want to make the call right here for the future? You want to pick a spot where you think that turns into a river? Keep in mind, the people of Xinjiang province and Kazakhstan are
have
a lot on this.
There are two enormous lobes in the southern part of the Gulf of Ob.
That's hot.
The Ob lobes.
Oh, I love a good Ob lobe.
One of them definitely feels like a river, and one of them feels like a lobe. And unfortunately,
back that up with science. It's not just a vibe, John.
The problem is that down here at the bottom of the lobe of the Gulf of Ob, there is a river delta, and then, I see, it's very complicated because they're still calling little inlets off of this Ob River. This is obviously, there's some politics here.
We need to dig into the Ob lobes.
There's politics because that is, I don't see how you call that the Ob River, my map-making friends. I don't know. I mean, how wide does an inlet have to be before? I mean, I guess you just measure the salinity.
You want to measure salinity, but what if that changes at different times of year?
It has to change every day, but right, at a certain point, there's going to be an average salinity.
This is a project for someone. We need to know where the Ob River turns fresh enough for John drink.
There are, again, going to be futurelings that have strong feelings about this. I know there will, because there are futurelings that have strong feelings about everything. There's a town called Novi Port.
Okay.
And there's an airport there, Airport S. Novi Port.
What's the three-letter designation? I'm going to fly in.
And Novi Port seems to me, it looks like from looking at the map, there's a lot of fishing boats. Seems like maybe it's either a research station or a fishing place. And I bet you asking the people of Novi Port what they think. Is their town on a river, or is their town on the ocean?
This is the new approach. Why should scientists in a lab somewhere get to say where the Ob River is?
Yeah.
It should be the actual people involved. Go to the people on the ground. All right, that's a project.
Okay.
If you have strong opinions on the Ob lobes, let us know. Do you think we could find some young leftists that would go snowblow the Ob lobes?
I definitely... Well, now let me ask you a question. Is Puget Sound the ocean?
I think for purposes like this, yes.
It's the ocean.
It's not a river, so yes, it's the ocean.
But when I talk around here about going down to the ocean...
Sure.
Everyone yells at me because they're like, it's not an ocean, it's the sound.
Oh, when I'm around here and I say we're going to the ocean, I would assume somebody means Ocean Shores or right. Seabrook or whatever that place is called.
But if you say, let's go down to the water, let's go down to
I would say water or beach for Puget Sound. But if somebody said ocean, I would assume they were taking a road trip.
But if you were standing at Richmond Beach with your toes in the water, would you say your toes were in the ocean?
Maybe not. But you know what? To me, that's wave dependent. Puget Sound is so calm that it doesn't feel like your toes are in the ocean. You know?
It feels like my toes are in the ocean when I put my toes in the ocean because there are clams.
There are clams.
And octopuses.
When I was little, we lived in Edmonds and you could see we had a view of the sound, which I'm sure today is worth a bajillion dollars.
Yeah, especially at the time.
They cut down all the trees.
$1,000 a
year. At the time, that house. Yes. That house. Allen, South Dakota could buy that house. And you could see you can see the Olympics across the way. And I guess my little brother told my little sister that was Japan. She was like, what's that across the water? And he was like, well, that's the ocean. You're seeing Japan.
It's plausible.
I think she believed it for a long time. Is it plausible though?
If Sarah Palin can see Russia from Palmer, Alaska.
That was Tina Fey. So we are now finally 3 hours later, arriving at the nominal subject of this show, Point Nemo. You know, if you've asked the question, what point on land is furthest from water? And the answer is somewhere outside Urumqi, China. The corresponding question is, what's the point on water that's furthest from land?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And you would probably guess that point to be where, John?
Pitcairn Island.
Very close, yes.
Oh, I'm close again.
Well, Pitcairn Island is, part of the Pitcairn Islands is one of the three points that defines what has come to be called Point Nemo. We did not have the, because of all the different islands that dot the Pacific, you're no longer looking for, the land case is pretty easy, you know?
Yeah.
Coasts are lines. Where right. are those lines closest to where? Whereas in the oceans, there's a bunch of little dots.
Right.
And we did not have the computation, the math available to define, and also probably didn't have the free time because we were
busy
smoking cigarettes and raising children and starting banks to determine what point on ocean is furthest from land.
I am very unsure about all of the remote islands of the South Pacific.
They make you nervous?
Well, no, I just want to know. Every time I look at them on a map, I go, okay, right. Sandwich Islands are there, and then these are the Marianas and the Gilbert Islands, and it's got this one over here, and then this guy, and then this one over here. And then as soon as I stop looking at the map, it all just turns into like, well, there's Tahiti. And then over there is New Zealand, and Samoa is...
I have the very vaguest idea of which ones are closer to New Zealand and which ones are closer to Hawaii.
Yeah, but
I'm the same way.
And there's so many islands that we know by name, and they're all those World War II islands and all of the Age of Exploration islands.
And popular middle-class destination islands right? like Fiji and Tahiti. And islands that our friends come from, like Samoa or Tonga.
But then you zoom in on an island that you think you understand, and it's actually a part of an archipelago where there's 40 islands, but only 10 of them are occupied. Anyway, it's a place of fascination to me.
That's why, part of the reason why I took until 1992.
Whoa!
For a Croatian-Canadian survey engineer named, I'm going to massacre this, Hrvoje Lukatela.
Yep.
To design a program called Hipparchus. Precisely for this purpose. Draw a bunch of triangles on the oceans and figure out what's the biggest circle of water.
It wasn't until 1992 that you could have even had a Croatian-Canadian.
That was the first Croatian-Canadian, do you think?
The first Croatian-Canadian to age to adulthood. A lot of them died as children.
You don't think Tesla counts as Croatian-Canadian?
No.
And Hipparchus actually delivered a result, which Lukatela nicknamed Point Nemo, not for the fish who did not yet exist, but for Captain Nemo, the enigmatic submarine captain of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, not just because he's associated with the open ocean, but also because Nemo means no man in Greek. Like when Odysseus fools the Cyclops asks Odysseus his name. Do you know this story? He's blind to the Cyclops. The Polyphemus is like, what's your name? Because that's what you do when somebody blinds you.
Sure.
Fair enough. At least tell me your name, buddy.
Every person I've ever blinded has asked me my name, and I've always given them a pseudonym.
Yeah, exactly. You can, because the guy's blinded now.
Yeah.
And the same thought occurs to Odysseus.
I always say Michael Jackson.
sorry, I blinded you. Odysseus says, my name is...
Shummel.
My name is Nemo, which means nobody. And so the Cyclops runs back to his buddies and they're like, hey, who blinded you? And he's like, Nemo, Nemo. And they're like, oh, okay.
Lol.
We're not worried.
Because it's...
Yeah. Who blinded you? Nobody. Oh, okay, cool.
He slipped and hit a headboard.
And you'd think at that point the Cyclops would be like, no, like, let me correct you on this point. It's a person whose name is Nemo. But that doesn't occur to him. So the who's on first routine goes on long enough for Odysseus and his men to escape.
Well done, Odysseus.
So given the fact that Nemo means no man and, you know, Jules Verne's guy had a secret South Pacific submarine and mysterious island base, he named it Point Nemo. And really, that's the one that's caught on within public attention because it's got a cool
name. It does have a cool name.
Point Nemo is 1,670 miles, almost to within 5 miles the length of your walk, away from three different islands. To the north, you've got Ducie Island, which is the furthermost extension of the Pitcairn Archipelago, where the Bounty
uninhabited
ended up. I believe all three of these are uninhabited. To the northeast, you've got Motu Nui, which is the westernmost extension of the Eastern Island Archipelago, and therefore Chile's westernmost point.
Oh, sure.
And then to the south, you go all the way down to basically off the Antarctic coast and Whoa. Tiny snowy Mar Island.
The Antarctic coast that, again, I never think of that side of Antarctica because what is there?
What's yeah, there? I mean, that's why Point Nemo is here, because literally nothing is there. This is the heart of the ocean. And it's pretty far south because, you know, whatever the point is, Antarctica is going to be the
right
the bottommost limit, and there's no islands down there.
But it feels like the point of geographic isolation in the north or on land somehow feels harder to get to than this because
you're right.
You have a boat and you go there.
Yes, a boat could directly go there. And that leads to the question, has anyone visited Point Nemo? And I think until a couple of years ago, the answer was, we think not. If you think about it, that circle inscribed by those three islands is, I mean, the radius is 1,670 miles. That circle's enormous. It's a circle the size of North America, basically. And
but none of those people sailing around the world ever thought, maybe I'll go down here and find paradise, cold paradise?
It's possible that someone did, and we don't know because they were not looking for it. Now that it's kind of become a thing, and you've got these guys, you know, either rich people on big yachts or retired people on small boats. Now that you've got them crossing the Pacific, they've got a GPS and they could easily be like, well, hey, let's go to 48 degrees, 52.6 minutes south, 123 degrees, 23.6 minutes west.
But has anyone done it?
Yes, apparently, but not until 2018 Whoa. Or so is the first documented visit I could find. And it was a result of the Ocean Race. Are you familiar with the Volvo-sponsored Ocean Race? You have to drive an XC60 across the ocean.
You put paddles instead of wheels. What's the Ocean Race, you say?
Yeah, it's like an 8-month thing that gets run every 3 to 4 years on some different path every year. But
is it a circumnavigating race?
Essentially, yes. The one we're going to talk about in 2018 went from Alicante, Spain, all the way, if you can imagine this, to The Hague, Netherlands. But they do not take the route you or I would take if we had to go between Alicante and The Hague.
Oh. Don't just go right
away. They don't hop on a high-speed train.
Or it's the long way around?
Yeah, they went, in this case, it's always a different route. In this case, they went by, and there are legs and stages. In this case, they went by way of Hong Kong, Auckland, and Itajaí, Brazil, which is, again, yeah. I want to warn the future, not the shortest route between Alicante and The Hague.
Are you allowed to go through the Suez Canal?
Let's see, how would they have done that? I mean, it's not a question of allowed. You follow. Yeah, right. Did they choose? My guess is they followed the African coast. No, they might have taken the Suez Canal.
What would be the point of doing it via the Suez Canal? This is supposed to be an 8-month race around the world. Of course you go around Africa, right?
Yes. What's the fun of it if you're not? In 2018, 7 different yachts spent.
And I hate all of them.
Right. All these guys took time off from the investment firm they founded. But we don't want to put down these yachtsmen too much because Volvo has gone to some lengths to make this ocean
Volvo
race.
Makes a green car.
No, yeah, they made a green race. They decided there would be a summit associated with the race this year about the health of the oceans and
Boring.
The ecology and so forth.
Then everybody puts $1,500 into a pot and buys carbon offsets. Boo.
So it's a branding thing, you know. Yeah, this is not just the idle rich in their boats. They care about
the health of the ocean.
No, Volvo loves the health of the ocean. So what they did was they had the boats do microplastic sampling no matter where they – at different points of the ocean. And that they – while they were running their leg between Auckland, New Zealand, and Itajaí, Brazil, they went right by Point Nemo.
Now, right by it or to it?
Well –
if they're 500 miles away from it, I don't care.
I didn't see a photo of anybody's GPS. I assume the race course goes through Point Nemo. Yeah, because they had multiple, because they want to say, hey, even at the furthest point from land, because you've seen these headlines where it's like, even the snow on Mount Everest now has
PCBs.
Yeah, exactly.
Anthrax.
There's Freon in the Amazon. And what they found was there are between 9 and 26 microplastic particles per cubic meter, even at Point Nemo, the furthest point on Earth from land.
Now, let me ask you, as an avid environmentalist who is compatible with Marxism, Is that kind of information just doom scrolling? Is there anything we can do about the microplastics at Point Nemo?
I mean, it's a broader question, you know? Like, I think it's not just...
Does knowing about it...
It's not just policymakers, but scientists that are grappling with, like, how frank are we about climate catastrophe? Because at what point do people just think, oh, good, nothing matters, and, you know, you turn everybody into climate nihilists.
Right.
It's...
How far are you from being a climate nihilist?
I mean, honestly, I used to rail at the boomers who were like, well, I'm going to die before this happens. And I don't have that option because I'm not going to die before this happens.
No, but you'll be pretty old.
That's true. I'll be insulated by privilege from the worst consequences.
Oh, I thought you were going to say insulated by a bubble of plastic.
I am building a giant plastic bubble around my neighborhood, of course.
Yeah.
And I would, if I were you, I don't want to say specifically why, but if I were you, I would start on that today.
The problem is I only have driftwood and laurel leaves to work with. So,
but yeah, anybody with kids, like you become a climate nihilist cause you're like, oh, what have we done? I guess I still have the utopian Star Trek kid in me who is like, you know, when our backs were to the wall, we came up with vaccines in a year. And I mean, that's not strictly true. We got lucky with mRNA, but...
I definitely am a Dr. Seuss scientist because I always believe that a small creature with a very flourishing mustache and a tuft of hair will invent a machine...
Exactly.
...that goes chug, 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 and turns all pollution into...
It's got two kid gloves on the end of its machine pipes.
That's right, and it reaches out and grabs all the microplastics, and it combines them and turns them back into Coke bottles.
Yes.
So I'm counting on the Dr. Seuss universe to solve all climate problems.
There is some micro science project like that, right? Didn't some kid invent some little Roomba that goes around the harbor of Dubai and picks up all the gunk?
And then 1,000 years from now, they'll be like, ah, the oceans are full of these little Roombas.
Yeah, it's Wall-E. That's the plot of Wall-E, I think. The thing about the Point Nemo is that is the clearest seawater on Earth. The yachtsmen of the ocean race were having much worse readings, you know, in any other harbor.
But
it's the clearest seawater on Earth as a result of the South Pacific gyre. You know, the Coriolis effect and the trade winds make for a big counterclockwise spin, which is what carries the garbage patch around the Pacific Ocean. But in the middle of that, you have an eye of the hurricane. And that's
Listen
Point
to yourself
Nemo.
Turn.
Listen to yourself turn. And that's Point Nemo, basically.
Oh.
Like, there's no land there to produce any organic material. And right. The nutrients don't get in because they're just getting swept around. They don't actually come in from the outside.
Oh, right.
So it's actually kind of a weird, lifeless area where the water stays clear and there's nothing to feed on it. You know, no food chains get created because there's so little of even the lowest level stuff getting through the whirling... twirling whirl.
So no fish, no sharks, no...
Comparatively few, fish or sharks. That did lead to questions in 1997 when Point Nemo was also the site of what is still called the bloop. Are you familiar with the bloop?
I love that word, bloop, but I didn't know it was a noun. I always thought it was an onomatopoeia.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes some of us have a bloop and then we have to go change our undies.
Sure, but like a bloop...
This is the like bloop with a capital
V. Bloop, capital B.
There's only been one capital B.
What bloop. Is the bloop?
NOAA Hydrophones in 1997 picked up a crazy sound that lasted for a full minute and was heard 3,000 miles away. And immediately there were a million theories.
And when you say NOAA, you don't mean N-O-A-H, you mean Sorry. N-O-A-A.
I mean the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
So, but when you said NOAA, I was like... Is this another one of these guys, some guy named Noah? Noah's hydrophones.
It was Yannick Noah. Point Noah.
So they heard a bloop that lasted for a minute?
A full minute. You can hear it 3,000 miles away through the ocean. And that's the question. You know, UFOs. Immediately all the paranormal people have theories.
Cryptozoologists.
And even the scientists can't agree because it doesn't seem to... Is it a volcano? Could it be something military? Is somebody blowing stuff up or launching new kinds of propulsion drives?
Did it sound
that we don't know about?
Like bloop? Bloop.
I mean, you're hearing it through water. I don't know if it sounds like bloop. Ellen DeGeneres speaking whale. But of course, all the, you know, this is the deepest, most mysterious island-free part of the ocean. Of course, a lot of the discussion comes to center on sea monsters. What is down there? What kind of kraken is making a noise that we have never heard before? And sadly, you're going to Google this and you're going to find that in the last 25 years, there's been a pretty boring scientific consensus, or cover-up, if you will, that what they're hearing is just, I think the word is cryocism.
Oh, cryocism.
You ever have a cryocism in your lower back?
I'm having one right now.
It's an earthquake, but in ice. It's an ice quake. It's caused by calving or fracturing or...
Why is that not a record album? Ice quake.
Ice quake. It could be called Cryosizen. That could be a prog band.
Cryosizen.
Sizen. So we think the bloop was nothing, and there are not ginormous sea monsters at the bottom of Point Nemo.
We think the bloop is nothing.
I speak for the scientific community here, John.
I speak for the trees.
you're a Dr. Seuss guy with a mustache and a tall hat. Mm-hmm. But the other, so despite the fact that nobody goes to Point Nemo except for seven dopes in yachts and their underpaid crews.
That would be a great Dr. Seuss book. Seven dopes in yachts.
Seven dopes
in yachts. The seven dopes.
It is to the other part of the scientific community. Point Nemo is basically the center of what's called the South Pacific Oceanic Uninhabited Area. Do you know why you want a big uninhabited circle of the largest possible circumference in the South Pacific?
You can finally stand on the deck of your ship naked and no one's going to see you.
I'm the king of the world.
why would you want a place where there was nothing?
We're not testing nukes there anymore.
To have an under-ocean UFO base?
That's essentially it. The answer is, in fact, spacecraft-related, John. But it's a spaceship cemetery.
Oh, sure. A Skylab crash zone.
This is where you're going to dump all your Skylabs and your mirrors and whatnot. You know, the margin of error is not, you know, for most things in space, if they're small, they will burn up on reentry. But when it's something the size of say your Skylab or your
right
International Space Station, it's not going to burn up no matter what. How shallow a trajectory you give it. It's going to dump chunks on Earth.
Dumping chunks. That's what these guys are all about.
First you got a bloop, and then if you're not careful, you dump chunks.
So did all the chump dunkers, the chunk dump dumpers of NASA and various Soviets. Yeah, the Soviets. Were they just sending stuff down there because no one would complain, and then later on they discovered that there was nothing there? Or
well, they knew there was no land there. I mean, you don't have to have Hervoye Lucatella's computer to tell you this is 1,000 miles from any island.
But you know, they were testing nukes places where there were definitely people living.
They had to move people, and then they just moved them to the nearest island.
Yeah, where they would have
a nice view of the mushroom cloud.
They were just doing it because those people didn't have contracts with anybody.
There's definitely a level of there is no jurisdiction down here, because today that includes there's no environmental jurisdiction down here. No government can tell us to stop dropping spaceships here. And this is there's very little research on what kind of ecological threat this could be. Like, we know that some of the rocket propellants in these spacecraft survive reentry, which means you're dumping hydrazine into the ocean, which is not good for sea life.
People have been doing that for 300 years, though.
And some of them have radioactive fuel sources.
Do they? Are we dumping nuke-powered rockets?
I don't know how hot it is. Did we have
nuke-powered rockets?
I think there is. I mean, not rockets, but that's essentially the battery of a lot of this orbiting stuff.
Right. Okay, got it. We're dumping luminous watches down there.
Yeah, basically. You got a chunk of... I'm going to say a made-up thing, and then people are going to complain.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm going to say there's a chunk of thorium now at the bottom of the ocean, and fish are, like, licking it.
Yeah, licking a chunk of thorium.
Please write me and tell me it's americium or cesium or something, but I'm telling you right now, I don't care that much.
It says right here that 2 million tons of hydrazine were used in foam-blowing agents in 2015 alone. Highly toxic. Used as a foaming agent.
And we're
just
making those little S-shaped packing peanuts?
Yeah.
And then just dumping them in the ocean?
It's a precursor to polymerization catalysts.
Oh, boy.
So that's what we're doing with that stuff.
Between 1971 and 2016, the combined space agencies of Earth ESA, Russia, Japan, China, NASA have dropped 263 spacecraft in or around
what?
Point Nemo.
Are you kidding?
So it is a cemetery. If satellites have ghosts, they are spooking it up at Point Nemo.
Well, what's happening is the UFOs that are under the ocean there are collecting all that stuff and building nanobots.
These include gigantic, like that's where Mir is. That's where most of Skylab went, I think, or at least parts of it. I didn't follow the size of all the chunks.
Skylab went into Australia.
Australia got a big, overland. Australia got a big dump of Skylab. But I don't know if, I mean, it broke apart high enough that.
Big dump of Skylab.
Six different Soviet Salyut stations and all the cargo transfer things that went up and dropped off whatever and then
fell back to Earth.
Just fell. They all end up in Point Nemo. And in January of 2031, it's just been announced that that's where the International Space Station will come to rest.
Of course, we're sending the big one down.
Hubble Space Telescope someday. I mean, we just don't have any place else to put this stuff. So Point Nemo, once the most far away and uninteresting and arbitrary point on Earth, like mathematically, literally the least interesting point on Earth, is now a spaceship magnet.
It's basically the Smithsonian Institution.
We just did. it's the Air and Space Museum. We just did like, what, an hour and 10 minutes on the most boring place on Earth.
And that concludes Point Nemo. Entry 958.JB3826. Certificate number 49394 in the omnibus. Futurelings, you're almost certainly listening to this program from your homes under the ocean at Point Nemo.
In converted fallen satellites.
That's right. In a basically a mega city made out of old mirrors. and we appreciate your patronage, and we're glad to have finally gotten around to talking about the mega city of the future.
This was a suggestion, by the way. Speaking of patrons, Point Nemo was suggested by Angus.
Thank you, Angus.
A Patreon donor at the Washing Bear level.
We love to hear from people out there who think of themselves as either a member of these guys or people that really work for oceanography organizations. What is that? Oceanography organizations.
Ocean-type outfits.
Or billionaires who have big submarines of their own.
If you have a big super yacht, I want to take John and me to Point Nemo.
Hello. Thank you.
John will play a show, and I will read on the deck.
I'll be the first musician to play a show at Point Nemo. We'll be the first podcasters to record an episode at Point Nemo.
This song's called The Bloop. 2, 3, 4.
Bloop, 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 bloop. I don't see how anyone listening to this show that has a mega yacht doesn't want to take us down there. Think we'd do 4 episodes a week about the stuff we encountered along the way. We'd win Pulitzer prizes.
Yes. We would, well, except we won't encounter anything on the way. That's the problem.
No, there's always some plastic like floating in the ocean.
1600 miles of nothing by definition.
Once a week, we would pull a Nike shoe or a doll or a piece of a Mir space station out of the ocean and we'd do a show on it.
Yeah. It would be like, what's the show? The unseen, the 100% 99% invisible.
Yeah.
99% invisible on the high seas. Hey, look, it's a Cabbage Patch Kid head.
Yeah. Hey, Ken, today's show is about a thing I saw in this night sky.
That's what podcasts were for hundreds of years. Just some Danish dude being like, I saw a light in Orion last night.
And
six weeks later, some dude in St. Petersburg is like, I too saw the light in Orion.
I tried to turn lead into gold again today. you can find all of this exciting mid-ocean podcasting at the Omnibus Project on all the places it is. You can watch our adventure by going onto social media. I might even rejoin Twitter.
Don't do it.
To tweet from mid-ocean.
Only if you're in the super yacht.
Because I wouldn't be able to see the replies.
Plus, you're outside any governmental jurisdiction.
At Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, you can email us, and we'll get it via satellite at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can socialize with other futurelings by putting futureling into whatever search engine you like. Put it into Bing. See what comes up.
Put it into the one that paranoids use, DuckDuckGo. Put it into DuckDuckGo.
DuckDuckGo and see what happens.
Then the NSA can't follow you or us.
You can actually help feed us because presumably the billionaire who loans us his yacht will...
Do you think he'll give us a per diem or a buffet?
I bet you there's great food on those things, but you and I are both gourmands. So halfway across the water, we'll be like, this again? You can help promote the you can help support the show, and at a certain level, the Washing Bear level, you can suggest a show like the one we did today by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject and joining as a supporter. And then finally, you can actually send us mail, and this mail will be forwarded to Point Nemo. But you send the mail to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Ken, did you just open some mail? Is that what I heard?
I did. Should I do this now? Or so. This show's already long.
Isn't it's long, but here we are.
Will the Thursday show be shorter? Should I save it 2 days?
No, I think you should do it now. I think you should just go for it. You know, we're always trying to get the shortest show, but also sometimes you just have to go for the longest show.
I don't think I can beat the DeGrosser record, and I don't want to particularly.
What is that, an hour and 30 minutes?
Well, this is our first ever note from Japan, which means it must have cost like 10 times as much to mail it to us as it did to purchase it. Thank you to...
Konnichiwa.
Thank you to Clark, that classic Japanese name.
Mm-hmm.
Clark... sent us little tiny Tomica diecast vehicle, the Japanese equivalent of Hot Wheels.
Super cute.
This is
they're matching too.
This is a red van, which would be iconic in Japan because this is their version of the U.S. Postal Service Grumman LLV.
Here, toss me one.
This is the Japan Post delivery vehicle.
It's adorbs.
This is not actual size, but they are kind of tiny. To make them more gas efficient. They also have motorcycles.
They're Suzukis.
He couldn't send us one of those.
Adorbed. Why could he not send us a motorcycle?
Nah, he looked for a model of one and couldn't find it. Send us a real motorcycle, Clark. Would I kill you?
How cute is this?
You're in Japan. You're obviously doing okay for yourself.
You know, I'm going to open this and thereby take away the original packaging, so the value of it just fell.
But. I think we need to know if Clark is some millionaire expat who should be sending us motorcycles, or if he's just some... guy teaching English lessons because he likes anime.
He's a guy that was teaching English lessons and then he met a Japanese girl and they got married and now he speaks fluent Japanese and is going to live there the rest of his life.
Please send us photos of your beautiful Amerasian children.
Oh, this is the cutest little thing. Look at this thing. It's a perfect little Hot
Wheel. It's 1/57th scale.
Oh, now I will never get bored.
Apparently there is a very long story of the kind of T-like logo.
Oh, and the back opens.
On the side of the postal van, which dates back to 1885.
It's a very modern-looking logo for 1885.
I think it used to be a Roman alphabet T standing for Teishinsho, which is the Ministry of Communications and Transportation. But then the T got changed to this T with a horizontal line above it. And it's possibly a pun. The Japanese word for two lines, Nihon, sounds very much like Nihon, the Japanese name for Japan. You're having a lot of fun over there, and no one can see, but everyone can hear.
Well, because the little van has, I've given it like a hot rod horsepower motor, so it's drifting now. It's like a little drifter van.
What city would you say that drift reminds you of, John? Is that any particular municipality kind of drift?
Is it a Tokyo drift?
Could be. Can't say it's not.
No, I'm doing it on the streets of San Francisco. This would be...
Actually, my truck delivers the mail in Hokkaido. I'm doing a Hakodate drift.
I feel like this would be like one of those JDM vehicles that you would see if we lived in California and people actually had a car culture. Every once in a while up here, what's popular right now is vintage Japanese fire trucks.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody's importing them to Seattle, and I keep seeing,
I've seen a few, and I'm like, what?
Hipster mustache kids that are meeting on Saturdays, and they all are driving like 40 horsepower Japanese fire trucks that still have all their hoses and stuff on them. But, they can't go on the freeway because they're too slow. But I bet you in California there are people that put like 400 horsepower Suzuki motos in these things and I don't know, ground effects light shows.
This is so nice, Clark. Thank you so much.
They're awesome.
If, in fact, you are a high-ranking executive for Union Carbide, though, please send me a motorcycle.
Yeah, I mean, right. If that's true, well, I'm kind of in the Austrian motorcycles scene right now. But you could say, oh, no, send me one of those Honda Africa Twins, those new ones. I would ride that all around the world.
You've got a shopping list. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final bloop. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.